This episode is brought to you by our newest Patreon subscriber, Ben Hughes. Ben's somebody that we've known for a long time, and we really appreciate his support of the show. Now that we're 18 episodes in and we have some content to work with, we're getting ready to post some of our outtakes and other bonus material that's going to be available to only Patreon subscribers. So we would encourage you to go to our website and check out the contribute page to find out how you can be a donor to this show. And once again, thank you to Ben for your support and your donation. Hey everybody, I'm Jake.
And I'm Allie.
And you're listening to episode 18 of Return to Sender.
Let's go. We live in one of the most racially charged times in recent U.S. history. And whether you're from an urban or suburban or rural area, your community has been touched in some way by a growing division amongst people that probably should not be there. So today we're going to talk about the Black Lives Matter movement, and we have our friend here from New York.
Hey guys.
All the way from New York.
All the way.
All the way. Very far away to come and talk to us about that movement. And this is Erin. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hey everybody. So I am all the way from New York, but I'm really from Baltimore. And if we're really being truthful, I have known Allie since we were in bibs and really embarrassing frilly dresses. So what I do in my adulting phase of my life is I am an attorney. I represent parents and children in the child welfare system. Sorry, parents in the child welfare system. And I'm also a team leader and supervising attorney at a holistic public defense office. And so I manage a team of lawyers, social workers, investigators, and advocates, and working with a client-centered model where we work with the indigent poor to mitigate consequences that systems impact in their life. So criminal arrest, immigration, housing proceedings, as well as Article 10 child welfare proceedings to ensure that they have the least amount of consequences possible. So for example, that might be someone comes in and maybe they have an arrest for marijuana that could lead to their kids getting removed from them. They could be deported if they're undocumented, and they could also lead to an eviction if they are in a public housing. So what we try to do is team that case, work together to ensure that none of those things happen versus working in silo, which many public defender offices do, and aren't able to address all those collateral consequences of that arrest. So that was a very long answer of my adult life.
It turns out adulting is like that. Nothing is simple.
I also am on the Black Mamas Matters Alliance. So I work with Black maternal health mortality and morbidity rates to minimize that, because Black women die at childbirth 3 to 4 more times likely than white women. And I also work with the New York State Department of Health in introducing a reproductive justice model into their healthcare systems to mitigate the harms of racism as it plays in healthcare systems.
So I have heard that stat before, and I'm interested to hear from somebody that is involved and knows about it. What are some of the factors that lead to that, 3 to 4 times rate?
So it's a really good question, because first the answer is that we don't know, because many states are not keeping accurate data on the deaths of women during their first year of birth. So the statistic actually encompasses 1 year postpartum. So it's birth and postpartum. Hospitals don't have to identify cause of death at birth. There are not review boards on the deaths of women. So one of the things that New York has and what we've instituted is a maternal mortality and morbidity review board. So it has to be reviewed by a separate board to see what the cause of death is. Now, to unpack that, the idea is, and what we believe is true, is that really Black women are dying at birth because of racism. So one of the issues and one of the stories you might have heard and talked about is Serena Williams, right? She has a history of preeclampsia. She understands her body. She has a pulmonary embolism, and the doctors are not listening to her. She's saying, hey, this is not normal. What's happening to me is not normal. And they're saying, it's fine. It's regular. It's okay. Don't worry about it. And it turns out if she wasn't able to push it, she would have bled out and she would have died. So that concept of Black women dying because of racism is a large question that we want to unpack. So the area that I focus on in particular are women that are low-income women who are also impacted by the child welfare system. So my clients will not, often do not seek consistent prenatal and postpartum care because they are afraid that they will lose their children. And there are a lot of factors of racism that go into the child welfare system that has caused a lot of health officials to believe they should report cases, and their misunderstandings of what that reporting does. And I could probably talk about this for a long period of time. And I'm happy to do that. But there's many different factors that come at that intersection point as to what is happening to Black women at birth. We know that they live in areas that have less hospitals, that have less access to transportation in rural areas. In Georgia, often people in rural areas, which are low income and people of color, have to go almost 90 minutes to get to a hospital.
Wow.
There's a movie called Death by Delivery, which kind of examines this issue. And so it's really looking at the public health implications of birth and prenatal and postpartum care in America, and all that contributing to poor birth outcomes for Black women.
So yeah, that's shocking to me that they, so they don't have to report a cause of death if a mother dies, not if a child dies, but if a mother dies in childbirth, they were not required. I guess they're still not technically required to report cause of death.
So it's reported to an internal hospital review board, but not to, when generally when you have a cause of death, it goes out to the coroner and has an external review. So understanding the root of the deaths is very difficult if it's only being reviewed within the context of the hospital system. And understandably, there's a large amount of oversight within hospital systems that are largely geared towards liability issues. And if you can also imagine, that's also one of the highest areas of being sued and for malpractice is at birth, right?
Right. Yeah.
Because if you lose your child, or if you lose your, if your spouse or partner dies at childbirth, like, that's a high engaged space to want to have damages.
Right.
So there is a lot of legal incentives already built into the hospital system to minimize the exposure to this information. And I understand that from, I mean, that's also a very complicated space because increase of malpractice insurance increases the cost of healthcare, the way our healthcare system is designed with lack of universal healthcare. That's a huge issue, right? The problem is that it shrouds this other issue of really understanding what's happening at the birth and what's happening to Black women at birth in particular, if we don't know.
It seems like such a three-layer issue. When you're talking about it, it seems like there's woven in pieces of poverty, and then there's race, and then there's gender layered on top. And it's like that, you know, when you talk about somebody having the triple threat, you know, they can sing, dance, and act. It's like, that's the opposite of that.
Correct.
It's like, if you're a woman and, you know, you're not white,
and
you're poor, you have nothing to go on.
So you're correct. Under a triple threat.
Yes.
You're like the under triple threat.
Yeah.
No, exactly. And so one thing that is true is what we know is that outside an economic buffer, Black women are still dying at higher rates. So I personally focus on low-income women of color. That's the area that I focus on. But even outside that statistic is a race statistic and not an economic statistic, which is very interesting because for many stats, economics is a buffer. It creates a level of privilege that uplifts someone. Even so, if you're Black and you're wealthy, you're going to have a different experience. And if you're Black and you're poor, this is not a statistic that tracks that, although it can, there are different issues that track poor people, which in my issue is reporting is going to be different in poor hospitals than it will be for women that have money, because that tracks Medicaid and the way women receive healthcare if they don't have access to private insurance.
Right.
Yeah, I think a lot of times people use economic status as, I don't know if excuse is the right word, but as a justification for, you know, when you look at certain stats, they go, wow, but that's probably because of economic status.
Mm.
And they just, you know, they use that as a way to ignore some of the other factors that may be going on. And that seems like a good example of it.
Yeah.
And people tend to conflate race and economics a lot of times. And I understand why, because especially when you live in an urban environment, it seems the same.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the way urban environments developed with industrial spaces where poor people also became people of color in the same areas because of the way jobs developed. That's not the same when you're in rural areas. It's a different way that the economic systems were set up. So you're not seeing that in the same way. But there's a lot of history as to why that's true. I mean, Black people were redlined out of living certain places. They weren't able to get certain jobs. They weren't able to do certain things. So they are more likely to be poor, but also for racist reasons.
Right.
So it's just a very complicated question, which you have to look at. I mean, that's the beauty of intersectionality, right? Like, you're supposed to look at each facet by itself. Like, we're not here to say being a poor white person is not a terrible thing in life. Like, it can be incredibly terrible to be a poor white person. It's just a different analysis of being a poor and Black person at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And did you see that? Where were you when you were in the Peace Corps, right? For a year, like shortly after college?
I was going to go to the Peace Corps.
Okay.
But I didn't go to the Peace Corps. I went to Tanzania for a while, though, but just my own. Okay,
that must have been what it was. I was going to ask if you saw like any similar structure. So like in Tanzania, like, did you see a similar structure in the idea that there were like wealthier areas and non-wealthy areas and things like that?
Well, first, why were you in Tanzania?
So I went, I just went to teach. Shout out to my really understanding parents, because I literally just went on Idealist and found jobs. And I was like, I'm going to move to Tanzania. And they were like, okay.
That's what Jane Goodall did. It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. It's all good. Everyone's fine. Everyone lived and survived. It's all fine. So the question was, did I find things to be the same as far as structures and development?
Yeah.
No, it's very different. I think we are a first world country.
Right.
We are incredibly developed. We have a large infrastructure. When you're in a third world country, there is no middle class. And so the divisions, the issues of economics are incredibly different. There's also no transparency in the government. There's no, the instance of corruption are very high. There's lack of, I mean, disenfranchisement happens because of just incredible poverty. Like, you can't vote if you don't have roads and you can't walk somewhere. Like, there's just so many different levels to say that it's not the same.
Well, it takes a massive effort from a government standpoint and, you know, an infrastructure standpoint to be able to really do anything on kind of a nationwide or even a statewide level. You know, when you've got millions of people that you're trying to coordinate to a single activity like voting, I mean, that takes a massive effort and a huge investment, not only in not only a monetary investment by the government, but then also an investment by volunteers and people who are willing to put their time and able to put in their time. Because if you're a, you know, largely poor area, how much incentive do you really have to take additional time out of your day and go set up a polling place or something? You know, it's a lot.
Correct.
Right.
I mean, the reality is like, not the same, because it's a very different level of poverty in certain places. But when you're surviving and that's the first thing in your mind, like other types of things that we take for granted are not your priority.
Yeah. I see that as so interesting, because when I started looking into millennials and like the group of people about our age and the Black Lives Matter movement, at the end of October in 2017, they did a poll of different races in the United States to see what are the top three things that you're most worried about? And African Americans said police brutality, racism, education. Asian Americans said gun control, homeland security, terrorism. Hispanic people said terrorism, immigration, education. And the white concerns were environment, climate change, healthcare. Like,
just really
when you have food and water, you don't have to strive for like food and water.
Correct.
Like, it's so, it's such a different understanding of like what you need versus what's nice to have.
Correct. Correct. And it's, I think, to move towards like thinking about Black Lives Matter, if you think you might die walking out on the street, or you think your kid might die walking on the street, like you're, the way you order yourself in this world and this society is going to be different. the way you treat your kids and your friends and your family is going to be different. The way you see your space in this world is going to be different. And your priorities are completely different. And I think it's sometimes, you know, I've had friends who say things like, oh, well, like Black people like don't respect like the environment. They don't respect. It's like, it's not that people don't respect those things. Those things are incredibly important. But like, if you literally think that you are going to die, that is your, that is a primal instinct that you live with. And it really is something that we feel.
Right.
Yeah. I'm assuming littering is probably not, you know, like way your, up in your thought your process
yeah.
when you're thinking, oh, I'm looking over my shoulder to make sure that, you know, somebody's not following me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just this past week or 2 weeks in Baltimore, there have been 2 17-year-olds killed. One just sitting in his car.
Yeah.
Sitting in his car. And it's like, well, that's yeah. outrageous. A high school senior sitting in his car, an athlete, you know, and he was mistaken for someone else. And it's like, that is such a constant, I feel like. And it's a really sad and negative and scary thing. And why are you going to worry about the environment and healthcare
right.
when you're worried about dying today?
Right. And all those things are really important to our survival and thrive and being able to thrive in society. It's just hard to prioritize that sometimes. And it's interesting because like before I started doing this work where I was actually in court systems and in jails and in detention centers or immigration centers and things of that nature, you know, I saw myself as a progressive person. And I knew that police brutality existed. I had worked for the Department of Justice doing their police brutality prosecution of police departments. But it wasn't until I actually started to see people every day. And there's just not an arraignment shift in the South Bronx where I don't see someone come in with, you know, a black eye or like with a bloodied mouth. And the stories we hear are about people being shot and killed, but literally every day I see people with like bruises and black eyes and marks just from being thrown up, from being kicked, from being pushed. We just had a community meeting with people from the South Bronx just to talk about their experiences, and got this amazing police officer who also came to like sit with us, and he was like, look, it happens all the time. He's like, I have colleagues who will, you know, rough someone up, and then they'll take them to the hospital and they'll mark them up as Jane Doe, or, and because it's a Jane Doe, you won't ever be able to track it to the police brutality. He's like, it happens all the time. And I think that that like low level of harassment that isn't being killed, but being like brutalized and harassed every day, it really opened my eyes to like, what is really happening? Mm. Because if we're seeing people being shot on body cameras, like absolutely people are being pushed up against the wall. Absolutely mm-hmm. people are getting kicked. Absolutely someone's getting like slapped across the face. And that's for men, for women.
Yeah.
It's
nasty. Our,
yeah. Like we're actually invisible. Like we're very invisible in this system because a lot of things that happen to us, like we're not necessarily shot. We definitely there is police violence on the behalf of black women, but also there's a lot of sexual assault.
Right. There's a lot of vulgar action.
Vulgar action, exchanging, you know, sexual favors for not being arrested, in areas of like sex trafficking. They've had women like I've had cops who have arrested clients that were in professional sex trafficking, or they were prostitutes, and they will arrest them after they have gotten a blowjob.
Oh my God.
They'll be like, oh, I'm the undercover. I'm like, that's egregious to me. Yeah. Like that is out of control. And those are the ones that we see. And there's a lot of exchange for like, okay, well, I won't arrest you if you do X, Y, Z, or like, I'll pat you down. I will grab and touch you in a different way. And those are things that aren't even quantified in data that we don't even see.
Hmm. Yeah. I think that's one of the things about the Black Lives Matter movement that I think has been overlooked is that it's not just what we see on the news. Like it's not a hashtag like campaign zero or the zero police brutality is the biggest portion of it, but it's such a big movement. Like there are leaders, there are local chapters. It's not just random people getting together. There are like actual things that are being pushed for, like economic justice and equitable education and healthcare and criminalization and, you know, incarceration rights. And like, there's so many things that it's not just like this, oh, we're going to go and break windows on a building
right.
kind of movement, that I don't think people always realize that.
Well, and I think it's fascinating because we seem to run into this same, the same sentiment with a lot of different areas. And that is, there's a big difference between the big bombshell moment and kind of the small drip of issues.
Mm.
And that's what you see here. So I compare it to something like Ebola. When Ebola hit...
Shout out to the scientists.
Yeah. So when Ebola hit, there was this flood of money coming in to help these people that were affected by Ebola.
I think we pause for a sec? Just real quick. I'll let you get to your point.
Okay, Kanye. What is it? What are you doing?
Ebola's been hitting in Africa since the 1970s. So you're saying the most recent Ebola
But you know what we mean.
Yes.
The last outbreak of Ebola. Right. Last outbreak of Ebola hit, this flood of money. I think the Red Cross was overwhelmed with the amount of money they were getting, versus when they have these constant issues like malaria or other things that are just always attacking these people. You just don't want to hear it. You know, it's like when a hurricane hits, everybody wants to throw money, but, you know, into poor communities where there's constant issues, you know, with housing and, you know, just getting these people basic needs. People aren't that interested in giving money until there's a big disaster. And it's the same thing here. And we've touched on it in other episodes where it's just, no matter what you're looking at, there's always this effect of when there's this one massive issue that everybody's like, wow, I can't believe that. Then they're willing to donate their time and effort and money versus these, you know, slow, constant issues.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's sad because of kind of the general attitude or view of the Black Lives Matter movement, which initiated with Trayvon Martin and then about a year later with Michael Brown being shot in Ferguson, people associated with only those things. And those were horrible, egregious things, but that's not like the only, right? So yeah. Now there's like a very... the view of the Black Lives Matter movement is kind of negative, right? And I don't think it should be.
I mean, I definitely don't think it should be. It's a very interesting phenomenon to me, and it has made me more aware of how we are racialized in America. Like, when you look at, like, Alicia Garza, basically it comes from a tweet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Patrice Cullors and Alicia Garza are looking at Trayvon Martin, this child who has a hoodie on, who has Skittles in his pocket, is shot and killed. Like, that is what happened. A child died walking home with candy in his pocket. And they tweet, hashtag Black Lives Matters. That's the root of it.
Right.
If we can't get behind that, a child not being shot for walking home in his own community, in his own neighborhood with Skittles, then that's really problematic that we have morphed it into something that feels like we can't support and is anti-security and anti-safety and anti-whiteness. It's not anti-anything. Mm. It's pro this child's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, as a mother of a Black son and a Black girl, like, there's nothing more important than me, like no other parent, than the success of our children, right?
Right.
Like, that's the most important thing to me. And so it grows out of this space where she's simply saying Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
And that affirming statement that my life matters becomes controversial.
Yeah, because I think that people are putting a qualifier in front of it. They're saying only Black Lives Matter.
Correct.
But that's not what
not
she
at all.
Said. She said Black Lives Matter. And I think I tried to add in like some other qualifiers to make it work. Like, Black lives should matter is what she's saying, or Black lives matter too, right? Like, we could all get behind the Me Too movement.
Yep.
Like, this is a our lives matter too.
Correct.
Movement. It's
correct.
Not a we matter and you don't.
Yeah, I think very often people look for a reason not to get behind it, or even a reason to be against it. And people do this with lots of things. So it's like, if it's something that they just don't like, or they don't want to, you know, get behind, they just pick out one little thing and they go, well, but see that, you know, this happened. So, yeah, you know, I'm not going to get, you know, one person might speak out and end up on YouTube, you know, that has a Black Lives Matter t-shirt, and they might do something that is not representative of the group. And that's just a target for people to go, well, I mean, that's the type of people that are behind them. So I'm not going to get behind a movement like that.
And it's tough, you know, because I think when we're talking about race, it puts people on the defensive automatically versus putting people on the reflective, right? And that's what makes it so, that's really the root of the issue. Like, the controversy is the problem. Hmm. The fact that I can't say that my life matters without you saying, but what about me?
Yeah.
Kind of is the most simple form of racism in America,
mm-hmm,
and the most simple kind of model of racialized America that we could possibly have, because no one said it didn't matter. You added that. That's your subconscious, mm-hmm, creating a dialogue within one sentence responding to me. And within that that internalization of what it means for me to say my life matters, for you to feel like you've done something wrong, and for you to feel like your life is now not mattered and it's a binary, to me, encapsulates what's problematic in society. We wouldn't go to a breast cancer rally and say, like, you know, I am running for the cure today. And people will be like, you know what? But like, there are so many other diseases out there, and I cannot believe that you didn't run for every cure, because AIDS matters, and
prostate cancer is a big problem. I don't know why only people care about women, because prostate cancer is a thing.
Correct.
So.
Like, no one goes to those things, and it doesn't put them on the defensive. Like, we are issue oriented all the time.
Right.
And we support things all the time that are issue focused on things that happen in your life, without it meaning your other life doesn't matter. Like, if I'm talking to a breast cancer survivor, like, my job is not to say, well, guess what? Like, last week, like, I was in a car accident, and like, nobody's talking about that. Like, my job is to listen to your experience about what it is to survive breast cancer, in the same way that I want to listen to this family that lost their 14-year-old son because someone shot them because they thought they were going in to get a gun when they were getting Skittles. Like, that's a problem. And I should be here to listen to that experience, not judge it, not feel like this is saying anything that's putting me down. But this is my listening space.
Right. And I think it's also really important to point out that in that incident, George Zimmerman is not a police officer.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like we're saying, you know, this specific police officer shot this kid with candy, which I'm sure happens. But in this case, it was a random neighborhood watch dude.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think the issue that you're pointing at there is that all of this stems from like people's failure to acknowledge the current situation in the United States. It's like sugarcoating everything. Like, well, oh, racism is gone.
Yeah, we fixed it.
It's over.
We got Obama.
We made a law. It's cool.
The laws don't exist, right?
Like, everyone listens to Beyonce now. Everyone listens to rap now. And we had a black president. So, like, it's done.
Yeah, it's totally
fine. It's totally done. We finished it.
We're good.
It's over.
Yeah. So,
I mean, yeah, I completely agree with you. Like, it's, I mean, but we're a society that has decided not to really reckon with our history. Like, we're not, like, Germany and South Africa really took an approach of doing a restorative justice approach to understanding the roots of their history. And
right,
we haven't done that in our schools. We haven't done that in our education. So there's not that confrontation with our history. Even as an adult, there was so much that I didn't know about even being a black woman in America that I have learned as an adult, but never was exposed to in my education growing up. And I think we all have that experience of like I think about it now, and it's like, I read maybe 3 black authors.
Right.
From K through 12. Like, that's wild.
I find that so interesting, because just this past Black History Month, there's somebody I know went into a library, and they were like, and there was a shelf out in the middle that had all the Black History Month authors. And, well, why? why put that out there? I don't understand. Well, what about all the other authors? And I was like, well, it's all the other books in the library.
Yeah.
Like, legit, all of them.
Yeah.
Like, there is this set, and we're pointing out this set because it's important. And the same thing happens in school as a teacher. I'll have kids. Why do we have a Black History Month? Well, because we've skipped this history.
Yeah.
The books were written like before this history, quote unquote, mattered. And it does matter.
It really matters. I think really because it helps people understand what is a systemic problem and what is an individual moral failing. And I think very often a lot of our structural issues in America get blamed on individual moral failings, like, oh, you're just not working hard enough, or you're not doing enough, or you're lazy, you're not caring. If you just worked harder, you could do certain things. And I think, like, what's a really good example is, you know, my grandfather works for the steel mill, just like many other people in that demographic or that age, so like what, like 1920s in Baltimore,
right?
And my dad remembers riding with him before he passed away and just being like, well, why didn't we live in these neighborhoods? Like, I didn't even know these neighborhoods existed. And my grandfather said to him, like, I couldn't buy what they wouldn't sell me.
Right.
And so now the home where my grandfather and my grandmother and their family lives is like one of the literal worst neighborhoods in Baltimore. Like, it's actually like, I'm not kidding. This isn't like, it's funny, but it's not funny. Right. It's like a scene is like, was a part of like the scene shots for The Wire. Like, that's exactly where my grandparents live. And like, that right. was the legacy that he could leave his family because that's what he could buy. Whereas white families that were in the same situation working those same industrial jobs at that time were able to buy in areas like where we are now and use the money. And to be explicit, because hi, radio people, you don't know where we are now.
Yeah.
Like, we're in a neighborhood that is middle class and that allows people to like have access to better education, like versus literally being one of the worst neighborhoods in Baltimore City. And they will never be able to sell that for more than, like, they will get more money if it is taken over by the government than if they were able to sell it at this particular time.
Yeah, they got to hope, like, Johns Hopkins comes and buys their neighborhood.
That's, like, really, honestly, like, and truly, like, his best case scenario. It's super dangerous over there. And he worked the same job.
Right.
But he wasn't sold the same properties. And so if you're not able to access that wealth and move forward and pass it to your kids, then, like, what can you do? Like, as a Black woman in my family, and for people who don't know me, hey guys, I have a white mom and a Black dad. I am the first Black woman in my family to ever go to college out of my entire family. My white family is incredibly poor. They're very impoverished growing up, my mom's side of the family, and all of them went to college. Like, their access to those types of education opportunities despite their poverty, which is something that wasn't available to the Black side of my family. And I think people, once we start to really understand that, like, that wasn't because people didn't want to go or weren't available, but because literally we were segregated until about 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And that is purposeful policies and laws, then people can start to understand why we are so separate.
It's why, like, when we thought about this episode, you were the first person that popped into our mind, not only because of the nature of your job, but because your ability to actually see two sides of the spectrum while growing up, to be like, I live in Baltimore City and my dad is a successful college professor and he's Black, and my mom is a successful woman and she's white, and let me see this whole scheme of life. And it's just such an interesting balance to understand, I think. And like, when I look at the success that you've had, you know, going to New York and being a lawyer and all these things, I'm always like, ah, oh, I wish I was more like Aaron.
I wish I was more like you. Oh, hey, girl. Love Fast here.
Thanks, yeah. Guys. I'm right here.
We don't left you out.
No okay. one wants to be a white male property owner.
No, we don't. We don't. We're good with what we got.
The Constitution was written for you.
Touche.
For us, by us.
Yeah, that's right. It's the original FUBU.
Oh Oh my gosh. But that's Let's make and that, a new brand.
Right. But even before we started the episode today, we were talking about just the taboo aspect of it. And it's nice to have somebody on who is not worried about talking about any of this. And that's so important to us. And it should be important to everybody, because I think the taboo is where that binary kind of me versus you mentality comes from, because it just gets to this, well, I don't want to talk about it, so I'm going to get rid of this conversation as quickly as possible. And this is how I'm going to do it. And I was listening to, I can never remember whether I was listening to something or reading something, but they were talking about death as a taboo. And there's this one town, probably in like Washington State or something. I don't know. But there's one town in the United States where everybody talks about death. They talk about what they want to happen to them when they die. They talk about death with their children all the time. And it creates this level of, it just gets rid of all that anxious, I don't know, all the anxiety around death when a family member dies, because you know exactly what they wanted. You know exactly what's supposed to happen to, you know, all their money, their body, everything. And it's not that uncomfortable situation that you're leaving people in. And just the fact that this town talks about it makes everything so much easier. And it's not an easy thing to do, yeah, to go, hey, let's just do that, everybody, you know, in the United States or even in the world. Let's just talk about it. But it was amazing what it did to this small town. And it would be a great thing if we could get it to be a little bit easier to talk about.
Well, and I think it's interesting because our generation was the first generation outside of the civil rights movement. So we were the first people to kind of be taught by our parents, mm-hmm, about actual equality. But I think that as a white kid, you got a little bit of a different story growing up. Like, I know one of the worst moments of my life, because I felt super guilty. So those of you, if you listen, you probably know I went to Towson University for a million years, and there's a bridge.
She's a doctor. Yes,
I am. And I got all my degrees there, but there's a bridge and it has this little curve that goes downstairs behind a building. And I was being super negligent walking down the middle of the stairs, and I'm like on my phone, and I go to turn this corner, and it's night and it's a night class, and I like half run into this kid, and I like jump back, and I'm like, and I don't even look up or know who it is. Turns out it's an African-American college student male, and he immediately takes his hood down. It's like, are you okay? And I know, like, I walked away from that moment knowing his mother told him to take his hood down. His, yeah, mother taught him, yeah, to be like, if you're near a white girl, it's your fault. And it was like, I just wanted to turn around and be like, it's not because you're black. I swear to God, yeah, I wasn't scared of you. I was just being a jerk on my cell phone walking down the stairs. And this, yeah, was like 2 years ago, and I can't get it out of my head. I just want to find that guy and be like, thank you. Thank you for respecting my space. And I'm sorry for being a jerk.
Like, it's tricky. And I think I think of two really different points. I'm going to go to yours second, Alex. I think yours is really complicated and I want to talk about it a lot more. But when it comes to having these hard conversations, you know, I feel really fortunate that you guys invited me, because I think that's really important, right? Like, I think there's a lot about white people that has an expectation that black people are the people to start the conversation. I think white people have to take the labor on to starting this conversation and be comfortable if someone's like, I'm just not really interested in talking right now, because it's a lot of labor to be like, let me tell you what it feels like to be a black person today. In the same way, it's like a lot of labor as a woman to like explain all of like the things that we do that are like unspoken labors in life and in marriages and in mothering and responsibilities. Like, there's invisible labors in every type of space of marginalization, because explaining marginalization is a labor within itself, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel really fortunate to be invited into the conversation. Like, just, I would implore people who are like wanting to be allies, like, do work on your own, research on your own, learn about these things, and also make space for people to have conversation and make space for people to have their own space too. I think that's really important. And then going to your conversation, like, and I'm just going to make it a little bit more, like, a little spicier. I hear everything you're saying.
Yeah, make it spicy. I'm ready.
I think this is a really interesting conversation about like intersectionalities of like gender and race, right? Mm. Like as a woman, we also feel outside of races and gender, like a different safety in our body. And we have this feeling of like when we're by ourselves, like a heightened sense of insecurity in the same way Black people feel a heightened sense of insecurity when they're out, right? For different historical reasons, but it's still a thing. And then there's another level of what it means to be a white woman encountering a Black man that then places a Black man in a different perspective where, you know, you have Emmett Till and historically they are seen as assaulting white women. And yet at the same time, like women have a history of not necessarily being assaulted by Black men. Like, that's not what I'm getting at, but like just having a sense of insecurity. So those are moments where we really need to truly explore like what is intersectional oppression look like? What are the histories of what he's feeling? What are the histories of what you're feeling? And we just don't have those complicated conversations, right? Like he has historical oppressions in a different way than a white man would have historical oppressions because he wouldn't have any historical oppressions having that encounter with you. If a white man was with you, like it would simply be about your physical safety and security that has a different legacy of oppression. But now that he's Black and there's a history of, you know, thinking that Black men rape white women or, you know, and they have anti-miscegenation laws. And that's why we have
books like To Kill a Mockingbird.
Correct. Right. That puts a whole different situation on it. But I also understand as a woman, like you're by yourself. Like we grasp our bodies and our own safety in a different way.
Right.
So how do we deal with that? What is even the space to have that conversation?
It's so hard. And that is two of the things I wrote down is like, I know when I'm at home with my girls, I already teach them, don't leave your drink unattended.
Yep.
Like when they leave a room, I'm like, why is your cup still there? It's open. Anybody can put anything in that. Like, don't leave it there.
Don't leave it there.
And it's the same way that Black moms have to teach their kids certain lessons. Like this is something you need to know about life. Like, don't do this.
You can't do it. You can't do it. You can't be by yourself. You need to make sure, like, if you're with a white woman, like, you need to have someone else with you in the same way that, like, we feel like as a woman, you want to make sure you're buddied up at a party. Like, you don't want to leave by yourself. You want to, like, it's creating a witness to your experience to validate whatever is happening because you need that when you're in these oppressed situations. In a way, there's just so many areas of, like, conversation that are similar between things that we do between women and race and all these that I think we can draw upon, but we don't have any of those conversations.
Yeah. And I think it's important for people to teach everyone these lessons because, you know, me sitting here as you know, a white guy, it would be really important for me to know these things that are being taught to the people around me.
Yeah.
So if I know that, you know, my friend who is a woman or my friend who is Black was taught certain things that they need to do, I could just be understanding and respectful of it and not say, oh, come on, man, that doesn't really matter. You know, you're with me or, you know, it's just not a big deal. But just to understand and go, no, it's fine. I get it. This is what you got to do. And then eventually we can get to a place where that's not what has to be done. But yeah, I just think if everybody were a little more open about talking about those things and understanding those things, it just helps build perspective to what the other person's going through.
Yeah, I think as growing up white in the generation I grew up in, it was really popular to say, like, I'm colorblind.
Yeah, I don't see color.
I don't see color. It was really popular then after that to start accusing people of reverse racism.
Yeah, like, that's not a thing.
It's like, okay, let's pause. Pump the
you
brakes.
Weren't a slave. Right. That didn't happen, so there's no reverse racism.
There were no...
Isn't reverse racism just like kindness?
that's true. If you're going to reverse it, it's like you're just being a good person.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I like, it's just... It's just interesting to like how to teach your children because my kids personally, they go to a school where they are the minority because of where we live, because of the school we have them in. And I love that. It's my favorite thing like about their life. But I get really nervous about middle school and really nervous about high school and what they're going to hear from their peers. And you know that, like, at some point there's going to be these outside influences. And it's like, how do you combat that? Because you're both going to be middle-class white girls, like, is what I have to think in my head.
Yeah. And I agree. Like, with someone who's not raising middle-class white girls, like, I'm raising middle-class black girl and black son. It's constantly a question of, like, how do I educate my children to feel good? Like, I worry, like, some, what's hard for me is, like, I want my kids to know that they are black. I want them to understand what that means in the society. I want them to be educated in how beautiful blackness is and how amazing who they are and what they are. It's also like, I also want them to be safe. I also want them to understand what other, how other people see them. But, like, do I do that with my beautiful 3-year-old? Like, how do I, like, you know, at some point you're like, you're, you know, my kid's on a play date and a little white girl is just, like, digging through her hair with her fingers. Like, my God, this is so funny. And, like, she's not trying to, like, exude any microaggressions, but, like, my kid's literally just getting her hair, like, pulled through with this, like, kid who's just, like, touching it like a sponge. And I'm just, like, sitting there, like, do I just let this happen? Do I stop it? Do I, like, have, like, do I let her just, like, explore it? Like, she's 3, so, like, she's chilling, or is she going to, like, what do you do in those moments? As a parent, like, we don't have any clue about anything, right? Like, we are making mistakes along the way as we go in so many ways. And we know now that the way our parents taught us about being colorblind, like, and having a parent, parents that are in an interracial relationship, they actually were very big colorblind people at the very beginning. They were like, because I think that was their generation. It's how they were taught. They're like, love is blind. Love is colorist. Like, it doesn't have any color. Like, and it, that was kind of the mantra of that generation, you know?
I wonder if they need,
like,
that.
We could be effing it up. Like, we could be messing up right now. Like, who knows?
Right. I wonder if they needed that, you know? Maybe at that time, that was the right movement to happen in terms of getting the conversation going.
Yeah.
So people always look to, you know, the feminists of the, was it the late 60s, 70s, as these crazy extremists. And in some ways they were, but in a lot of ways that's what was needed to get the conversation going. So on a lesser scale, maybe that was, maybe colorblind was like, hey, we're going to take it to the extreme.
Right.
And then pull back. There.
I don't know. You know, I mean, and it's like, I can't knock it, right? Like, my parents were in the first generation that could have lawful interracial marriages. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm the first generation of children that was born from interracial. Like, so, like, I can't knock it. Like, I wasn't back there, like, getting married to someone outside my race when it just became legal, right? Like, that's a big deal. But it wasn't healthy. And now I find myself in these tough situations with my kids, and I'm like, you know, it's harder than it looks. It's a lot easier to sit here and have this conversation with each other than to kind of get it right from the beginning with our kids.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, especially with that situation with the hair, it's like, well, they're 2 kids getting along. Do you want to create some tension between them by stopping, like, it? Or do you, you know,
because, like, 2 seconds so later, you know, they're going to be throwing Play-Doh at each other.
Right. It's like, do I teach the lesson or do I, you know... Because that's what you want, is for it not to be awkward and for them to just be friends. And it's like, at that young of an age, that's what they're doing. They're just being friends and exploring each other. And
it's different. Like, she has different hair from this white girl. And my daughter's in the opposite situation. We live in the Bronx. It's primarily people of color. One of the reasons why we live there is because I wanted my kids to grow up in, at least from 0 to 5, in a space where they were... felt like they were in the majority. So I thought that was really healthy for them developmentally, to, like, see people from all levels of life look like them. But now when they are interacting with white people, which I want them to do, it is really different because they're exploring a lot of newness that they're not used to, like, having.
I find that so interesting that, like, your goal as a mother is to have your kids grow up feeling as if they see themselves as part of the majority. And our goal as parents has really been to keep our kids in the minority.
Yeah.
That is something that I've pushed for. So not like
it's looking to the future.
Yeah.
Because what happens is, in the future, our kids are going to be in the majority.
Yeah, and the kids were going to be out of this stupid bubble that we've like created for our kids from 0 to 8.
At some point.
And they're going to revisit this podcast because we were probably going to be like, we were the worst.
Yeah.
No, they're going to listen and be like, I love you, Mom.
But what you've
done. Are they going to like use this in their dissertations?
Yeah.
Like,
God bless.
See, I like it though because
or they'll use it to be like, this is what's wrong with me. Now I'm a shrink.
No. Well, you only get one chance though, right? You only get one chance to do that because yeah. you can't create that when they're older and more knowledgeable. So we've given our kids an opportunity to experience something different, something that they won't be able to experience yeah. as adults.
So that's cool. Oh, I like the way you said that. Yeah. Oh, the white man just really did a good job with that. Good job. Well done. Is that why you got the Constitution?
Justifying your parenting.
We the people.
Yeah.
There's a little girl in my daughter's class in second grade who was playing with myself and my daughter at like one of the after school events. And we were talking about how my daughter's the only one named Caroline. And she was like, oh, well, I'm Talia. And there's another Talia that goes to school here. And I was like, I didn't know that. Who is she? She was like, oh, it's easy to tell. She's the white one. I'm the black one. My daughter was like, what? I don't get, like, you could tell it was so open, like, in her life, like she's continually like, yeah. I'm the black one, like yeah. I refer to myself as the black one.
Yeah.
It's so interesting how like those words don't like creep into white children's like habits until way later. I guess people like tiptoe around it.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but it was so interesting to me that she was so open. And I was like, Talia, get it, girl.
Get it, girl. Get it, girl. And it's true. Like, we spent a lot of time talking about race in my and with my kids, and like reading books about race and reading books that like we really try to endeavor to like find representation for them. Because we just feel honestly, my kids still think that Obama is the president. Like, they don't know about Trump. We don't really talk about him. Like, we really try to minimize images of him. Like, and we didn't do it on purpose. We did do it on purpose in the sense that, like, there was a lot of language we weren't ready for our children to be introduced to with this election. Mm-hmm. Like, we just felt like that was really complicated and they're little. But then we realized that they thought Obama was still the president. And they were like, we didn't mean to like erase reality for you.
But maybe we'll let that.
But I was like, but maybe
it's like believing in Santa Claus.
Like, I mean, it really was a moment of like, oh, crap. Like, we've like erased reality. Like, and really thinking through like, what did that mean? But then we were kind of like, we're going to rock it. Like, look, if you got it for a few years, like, we're going to ride it and we'll see what happens later, because it is a really complicated time for like our kids to grow up. And, you know, it's a different space. Like, my child was born when Black Lives Matter was born.
Mm.
And I think about that a lot, that like her birth was, and it changed me. It really did. Like, my work, the things that I write, the things that I do really shifted with the movement and with having a child.
Mm-hmm.
Because having a baby and then seeing people's babies that look like your kids that can grow up die simply for being kids, like, just, it shook me. It shook me in a different way. And I think like anyone who has kids, like, it shakes you, right? It opens you up in a way. Like, it makes you sensitive to the world in a different way. And to birth a child at the same time that Black Lives Matter came out, and you were seeing just every month, it felt like another person being shot. It was overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, I think there's no way that this generation of parents, if you are conscious at all, that didn't impact you. Like, we watch people die on tape. Like, we watch Philando Castile get shot on video on our news. Like, that's in our historical memory. That's going to be a part of our American trauma that we exist with. Like, that's going to impact our parenting. So, like, hopefully our kids will survive it. Hopefully they'll be a little bit better as a result of it. And, like, to me, that will be the success of the movement.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's why Trayvon Martin kicked this whole thing off in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement, because it was not a police officer. Because I think the defense, and I think in some cases it's a valid defense of the cops' fear for their lives in certain situations, and they're put in a very, very difficult position. With Trayvon Martin, it was not a police officer. It was not somebody whose responsibility was the safety of the community. And so that excuse didn't exist in that situation. And I wonder if that's what helped kicked it off. Because I know with a lot of these, you know, people come back to, well, what was the police officer supposed to do? And I think sometimes it's difficult to look back and go, well, he did or did not make the right decision. You know, sometimes it's more clear that they didn't. Sometimes it's more clear that they did. But in Trayvon Martin's case, we didn't have that police officer responsibility of protecting the community.
Well, I think in Trayvon Martin's case, his mother was, I mean, at the vigil, she like, it was just her saying like, I love you. I love us. Our lives matter. Like she said that physically out mm-hmm. loud at the vigil. And that's what kind of got it started off. And then when Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson a year later, that's when it became a hashtag. But I think to your point on like the quote unquote blue lives matter type of deal, like, yes, you know, police officers matter. But I think like the difference there is that when you leave work for the day, you can take your uniform off. Like you chose mm-hmm. to be blue. You can't choose your race. And I think that that's the big difference. It's kind of like the Spider-Man thing. With great power comes great responsibility. And it's like, yeah, you are in danger. You know, yes, you do deal with crime. Yes, you do deal with people when they're at their angriest. But you also have a responsibility to society to know that a young black man and a young white man and a young white woman and a young Hispanic woman are all like equally committing the same crime, which I think is the egregious fault of some police officers. Not all, some.
Yeah, certainly. But that is, so what I don't want to do is just go through this whole thing and just everybody agree the whole time and it's all hunky-dory.
I agree.
There
yeah,
are
you're
challenges
right.
to these points, and I want to address those, especially when we're, you know, have an opportunity to sit down with somebody who thinks a lot about this and obviously cares a lot about this. So, yeah, I mean, to that point, you know, in situations where police officers have to make decisions, yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, first, I will say that if anyone believes that Blue Lives Matter is anything other than really concerted branding for and by police unions, you are very naive.
Yes, and I did not say Blue Lives Matter.
I'm just saying that's from a first
point. Right.
That to me, that's a starting point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's a you versus us mentality. That's not the point.
Police unions are incredibly powerful, incredibly targeted. They work really hard at supporting a state-sanctioned violence model, which they have. Like, that's not even a criticism of the police. Police are able to use violence in ways that regular citizens can't, and they work really hard in justifying the use of that model. They are a union. They are represented.
What was that model called?
A state-sanctioned violence model.
Sanctioned violence.
They are allowed to use violence. They mm-hmm. have guns. Yeah. They can kill people lawfully.
Yep.
That's in a different space than me and you. We have very yeah. few times where we can lawfully kill people
right.
in comparison to a police officer. And it's not a criticism. It's just a statement of fact.
Yeah.
And so we have to first understand the root of Blue Lives Matter and the way that it is used as propaganda as a part of a mission to rebrand the argument from police unions. That's first and foremost. Mm-hmm. Second, we have to understand that, yes, police officers do have a hard job. And as society, we have made their job harder by defunding so many things. Mm. We have made police officers responsible for drug treatment, for mental health, for our inadequate funding of schools. Like, we have made them responsible for all the things that we didn't want to fund. And that's very problematic. If we had access to quality health care where people could actually go and get mental health treatment that was respectful and honored them as people, that was open and available to them. We had access to treatment centers that were also centered around patients and available and open and didn't have a wait list for people, police officers may not have to encounter situations that they're not trained for. They're not trained for many of the situations that they encounter. And so I agree that they have a hard job. The third point would be that they work for the government. I'm sorry, it is not the same to hold a police officer to the same standard as it is for a private citizen. And I will never take on that ownership of their responsibility. In the same way that when I was a teacher, and for our teachers, like, you can't yell at a student in the same way that you might yell at a kid on the street. You can't do the same things when you decide to put that uniform on. You are the government at that point, and there is a special responsibility to act differently. And so we can't equate Black Lives Matters and Blue Lives Matters. We can't say, okay, well, there's black on black crime, and so that justifies police crime because people are all killing each other, so it's all the same. It's not all the same. Like, you have a special duty. I want, as a citizen, and I truly want as a citizen, to feel secure in my government. I don't need to feel secure in you, Allie, or you, Jake. Like, I want to, but I don't need to. I need to feel secure in my government. I need to feel like my government's going to have a special duty. I need to feel like they have special responsibilities to protect me. And to make them seem like we have equivalent responsibilities is really a huge problematic. It's a huge problem legally, policy-wise, and with the consciousness of America. That's a huge problem to make that equal.
Yeah.
And I think that when people use that as a model, they really flip the narrative in a way that's really troubling to me. It's like, you're saying that this police officer who is who isn't necessarily highly trained, so we should maybe put some more money into their training, who is a government entity, can fear and have implicit bias and racism, and that's okay when he kills this black 14-year-old kid reaching, you know, or this man who, you know, like Eric Garner, who's reaching for cigarettes and use a chokehold. Like, that's not okay. And we need to say that that's not okay. Because if the first step to fixing the problem is to say it wasn't okay. And we haven't even collectively said that it wasn't okay. We try to find ways to blame it and figure out what's going on. And I'm not here to create harsher penalties for anyone. That's really not my love of my life. But like, what I do want is to create accountability. And if we're not saying it's wrong, I'm not trying to make you like lose your job. I'm not trying to make you like never be able to pay for like your kid's school. Like, I'm not a really punitive person by nature. But I do want you to get better at what you do. And you won't even say that you're wrong. So how are you going to get better at what you do?
Yeah, because I think we've kind of created, maybe on purpose, maybe not, this situation where it is either you're 100% right or 100% wrong, and the penalties are that harsh either way. It's either you are off completely or your life is ruined. And yeah, maybe there is some middle ground where we go, hey, we're not sure what happened here, so maybe we need to take some serious action and, you know, not just decide, okay, we're either going to let you off or we're going to throw you in jail.
Or like, we are sure. We watched it on tape. You shouldn't have done that. Say, like, you were wrong. And that was a big problem. And so how do we fix it?
Right.
And it's like, you got to be accountable. And it's like, we do this with our kids all the time, but somehow when we become adults, we stop making people do this. Like, you got it. Like, you don't watch your kid do something to another kid and don't tell them to say they're sorry and go back and try to fix it.
Right.
Like, it doesn't mean you stop mothering or fathering that child, but you make people encounter their bad actions. And I think that we don't do that here in so many ways. Like, we don't encounter our bad actions as Americans in society, in our history, in our schools. We don't do it with these situations with police. We don't have the hard conversations in any place. And this is the probably controversial part. Like, me as a person who is like dedicated to be a defense attorney, like, I'm just not a punitive person. Like, it's just not my nature. Like, I don't really feel like punishment really changes people's behaviors. like that's why I defend people, not because people don't do bad things, but because I don't think that that really changes things for people. And I also personally feel the same way for officers. Like, I don't think it's about being like overly punitive. I think it's about forcing responsibility and accountability and culture change, which is to me, a much harder task.
Well, I think that you've taken on culture change, like in your personal life very seriously. Like I just watching you via social media and things like that, where you'll put up a gorgeous picture of like your husband doing your daughter's hair and hashtag it Black Dads, or you'll like put up a picture of you at work with all your female Black coworkers and be like, look, we are professional women. Mm-hmm. Look at us. Like, you need to see us. And I think that that's a really powerful thing to do to change some of that culture.
I agree. I think that like a lot of what we can do, and there's a lot of dangers about social media, right? Like, who knows what my kids will say about the amount of pictures I put of them on the internet, you know, later on in life. Cause like we didn't have that growing up. So I'm sorry, kids. You have, now 73 minutes of tape footage to play for your therapist. I'm here for you. I still love you. But a lot of it, what makes people unsafe in the world is the lack of interaction, a lack of understanding, the lack of questioning. So one value for social media, in my personal opinion, is creating more images. And those images can really start to stop people's implicit bias processes, which is really like a cognitive brain process. Like when you're in fight or flight, like what you experience at Towson's, like you're in fight or flight. Fight or flight is where your biases lie. And it's how you are created as a human. Like, we are created biologically to shape and respond in dangerous situations or ways that our body chemically perceives as danger and stereotypes. So one good example that people talk about implicit bias is like when you're encountering an animal in like the jungle. Like, I know we don't do this anymore, but like that's how our bodies are created. Like
straight up Mowgli.
Like, let's just do straight up Mowgli. Like, so you're straight up Mowgli in life. And the idea is that your brain isn't going to figure out what animal exactly is coming at you. So you are thinking it's a bear, it's a lion. Like, you don't know. It doesn't matter. The purpose is that your body is creating responses to whatever it sees based on what it knows in a very quick way. That's the way implicit bias works.
Right.
It is buried in stereotypes. And so if you can rebrand and reshape what you're seeing on a daily basis, right, you can start to shift what is your baseline stereotype.
It's like physical therapy.
Yeah.
I feel like the wounds that we've put into place in this country, let me back up. Our system is not broken. Our system is working the way that it was built.
Correct.
And I think that that's an important thing to note. And then there were 150 years of actions and laws separating people or modeling unseparating people.
Mm-hmm.
And those wounds haven't healed. Like, if you fall straight on your hands when you're 5 years old and hurt your wrist, you might still feel it when you're 35.
Correct.
Like, that is real life, that there are things that haven't healed in our country that we have not addressed and are pretending aren't there. Mm-hmm. And if you don't keep going to the doctor and you don't keep talking about it, it's a rough thing. And like, I know we mentioned this conversation earlier. I was like, look, you know, Aaron is my older cousin's childhood friend. I don't want her to think I'm calling over here because she's a Black person I know. It's like,
yeah,
you have to be aware of the fact that it's like, what are people going to think if I say this? But also open enough to say, I want to know how you feel about this and I want to start to heal this wound.
Yeah, I agree. And it's like, even saying those discomforts out loud are really important, right? Because maybe that is, I mean, I didn't feel that way, but like maybe that is what people would feel. And like, if you say it out loud, it gives people the opportunity to say, I didn't feel that way, or I did feel that way. And like, let's have that conversation. Like, you're not going to just leave these hard conversations not feeling hurt sometimes, or not feeling like awkward, or not feeling uncomfortable. And that's the point, right? Like, you don't have true change without discomfort. And I think we are very wedded to feeling comfortable in many ways, to the point where we have created impossible situations of oppression. And these really hard conversations, even with like people who you really love and have known for a long time. Like, I've known you for now like 30 years.
Yeah, since I was a baby.
First conversation about race.
Yeah.
But like, isn't that wild?
It is.
Yeah.
Right?
And what's funny is your parents were the first interracial couple that I knew. Like, I remember meeting your parents as a maybe 3-year-old and saying to Carrie, they're married?
Yeah.
Like, I remember being confused as a 3-year-old.
Like, that didn't compute as a 3-year-old?
No, it didn't compute. And it should have, but it didn't as a 3-year-old. And I remember her being like, people who are different can be in love. Like, yeah. And me being like, oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, and there's things like, even tonight we went out to dinner with my family, my parents, and they asked if we wanted separate checks. And I was like, no, like, we're all one family. Like, we don't need separate. Like, you know, it happens all the time, right? But like, we don't endeavor in these conversations. Like, it wasn't something that like we sat and like, we're going to facilitate a conversation like this, and we're going to talk this through, or we're going to have conversation and figure it out. And I think that like the missed opportunity, and going back to like the school Black History Month thing, like that's the purpose of highlighting these books at Black History Month, because like, it isn't always the most comfortable conversation to do it when your kids are at a play date. Like, I do think it's incumbent on our educational systems and to really try to create these conversational spaces, because if we don't do it in those spaces, if we don't try to really bring these up as topics, and there's no neutral space to talk about it, then it's only happening in spaces of conflict or spaces of microaggression, right? Then that's the only time that you're having it. Like, very few people have the privilege of having a friend who has their own podcast that then you can like intellectualize about race in an abstract way. Otherwise, we're doing it in spaces of, you just hurt me.
Right.
Or this just happened to me. Or I am traumatized by watching people who look like my family get shot on TV. And I'm asking you to then have that conversation with me. But like, I'm not in a healed place if I'm watching people who look like my brothers, my kids, like, get shot. Like, those aren't neutral spaces to have conversations. You
so
know?
We need more Switzerland.
More Switzerland, more podcasts.
Right.
More Black History Month book celebrations.
Yeah,
it is a great point.
Why don't we put out kiosks of Black books on not Black History
Correct.
Month? Maybe that.
Correct, correct, correct.
Well, we are. And I mean, you just touched on it. We're in this position of just incredible privilege to be able to talk about this. One, in this little microcosm of our, you know, living room here, where we get to talk about this. But then Americans in general are so privileged, yeah, when you look at the rest of the world, that, you know, we are in a situation that most other countries aren't in, which is an enormous amount of diversity. But we're so privileged to be able to address these problems. And I think we've got to remember that moving forward, that it is going to be uncomfortable, but it is worth having the conversation, and it's not always going to end well, you know. But, you know, we were talking about this before you came over. Allie and I were discussing this, and she was like, I hope I don't say anything that's too. And I said, you know what? As long as you're coming at this from the perspective of, I want to learn, I want to discuss this with you. And I said, even if you slip up and say something that you wish you hadn't have said, it still is all coming from a place of, I just want to learn more and I want to hear what you have to say about it. I said, if you do that, then you're going to be fine. I said, people, yeah, will forgive you if you say something you wish you wouldn't have said, because the important thing is you came at it from the right place.
And I think that's a really, like, that's the lesson I want to teach my kids, is like, we're all in process of learning language to make the world feel respected. Like, Okay, I am a centered community when you're talking about race and gender. So to me, I feel like I can really talk about that and have an explosive conversation. I'm not going to be your centered community when you're talking about like gender binaries and when you're talking about, you know, getting outside of what's heteronormative in the world. And so I don't do always say the right words. I don't always use it correctly. And I think we've gotten to this place where we are so judgmental when people make mistakes. And like, I get it, right? Like, cause the mistakes are triggering trauma, and I'm not judging. Like, I get it. Like, I've had that experience where like people say something and like, it hurts me because it's like, I've experienced that as a microaggression and in my life, but like, we don't know how to handle it. We're not like, when people go into a space where it's harsh, people aren't saying like, oh, well, you know, I have experienced racism, sexism, you know, transphobia, different types of isms and phobias. And so I'm responding this way. And so I, as a person who's not in that centered community, needs to hear it differently. And people also aren't able to just let people grow in their language development and their respect. And that's really hard. And I think that is a responsibility as parents that we have in our kids.
Yeah. I think it's a responsibility to the community in general for everybody to just be understanding that they're not an expert in everything. Like,
well, there's so many, when, because of the internet, there's so many. One, there are a lot of real experts and that we have access to, which is pretty crazy. I mean, normally, you know, before the internet, you didn't have access.
You had like whatever was A through Z in your Britannica.
Yeah, Britannica, and that was it. But then you also have this flood of pretend experts who really don't know anything, but they have the same opportunity to put it out there on the internet. So it is so hard to sift through all that. And it does make people feel stupid sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's been one of the awesome things about doing this podcast, is we've touched on so many different areas, and nobody can be an expert in all those, and we're not an expert in basically any of them. but we get to sit here and talk to people who,
you know, Disney,
either do have an expertise.
I am an expert in Disney. Does have an expertise there.
But it's great to be able to sit down with people who do know a lot about this or are passionate about it, and just say, hey, we're going to talk about it, and guess what, we're probably going to get things wrong, and that's okay.
Well, I think that's the biggest thing I learned from going through the doctoral program, was that I really know nothing.
Yeah.
And I've learned how to learn things. And it takes so many years to become an expert in something. And asking questions is how you do it. And there are questions surrounding race that are hard to ask because you're scared of the other person's reaction. And I think that goes in so many directions for so many different microcosms, like you were saying. So it is just such an interesting thing to do, and more people should do it with the people around them. And then maybe we can close some of this divide.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. It's, you know, I think the theme of this episode is like, how do you have the difficult conversations? How do we teach people to have the difficult conversations? Like, who's the starter? Who's the listener? Who's the person to like push more? And how do you stop them when they're hurting? How do you continue them to push yourself forward? I don't know that we really endeavor in that all the time, you know? And I really appreciate you guys like having me here to have that conversation. It's nice to do it in a space where it's like, I've known you for so long. So like, I feel a trust. Like, that to me is first and foremost. Like, I trust people that I know for a long time. So like, even if there's mistakes that are made, it's like, but I know you. I know where your heart is. I know where your values are. I know where your vision is, right? I think when we don't even do it, and we didn't do it, this is 30 years and our first conversation. I think that's the point.
And we 30 years is the point when you need to have the race conversation.
Right, correct. Year 30, that's when you have it. I think that's, you know, revelatory in a lot of ways, because like, it lets us understand that that's how long it has taken people who's known each other to have this conversation. And so, right, like, how do, and you were still laughable. Nervous
yes
before coming into it, like, that's real. And so we have to really acknowledge all of that went into it, to really think about like, how do we raise these kids to do it better, because we want them to be able to like grow in their language, grow in their respect, grow in their openness to whatever is the new thing, that the thing that we have probably disrespected in this conversation. Sorry, kids. I'm sure there's something I did wrong.
Sorry, guys.
Sorry. Sorry, future kids. Like, I'm sure there's something, because there's something that they're going to think about that we didn't think about, you know?
And it'll be like the colorblind thing.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Whatever we've said.
I'm sure we have messed up something. And like, that's the thing. Is like, I like to think it, like, I feel like I'm always messing up. I'm always saying what I feel right now. And I always am like, I have understanding that I didn't know everything that I know today.
That's
yesterday.
That's how I know you're smart.
Yeah. I'm like, I didn't know that yesterday. Now I'm maybe know it today, and tomorrow, maybe hopefully I'll be a little bit smarter. Who knows?
Well, and that's been one of the amazing things about having this podcast is having the opportunity to have meaningful conversations with friends of ours. And we just... People don't do it very often. We never did it. I mean, we never had just, you know, one or two people over and had a long, meaningful conversation about an important topic, because it's kind of odd. People don't generally do it. You know, normally it's a party situation. Everybody's just,
I like how
out,
we made it less odd by having a podcast.
Right.
Yeah, let's record it. Yeah. Guys, let's pump up this podcast.
Let's make it. Let's
other reasons this podcast is great are as follows.
But this has been fantastic. Aaron, we appreciate so much you coming by.
Thank you. And thank you for the wine.
Us.
I just want to put that on the record.
Yes.
There's been two glasses.
We'll have to steal your husband soon and get
he's
his
the best.
Thoughts on all the things.
Yeah, he is all the things and all the thoughts and all the people all
this
the time.
This is how long I've known Aaron. At our wedding, Adam, her husband, walked around with a disposable camera to take pictures.
Oh, he's the best. I just remembered that. Also, nobody has disposable cameras anymore.
They're yellow, everyone who's listening. They're yellow.
They're green. A thing. Future children, we used to have to take pictures and on a device and send them to a store to get pictures developed,
and they would print it out, not just developed.
You're welcome. You're welcome, future kids and their shrinks.
Yeah.
Depending on when this comes out, we're gonna have to explain to kids what a printer is. They're not gonna know anymore.
Seriously, thank you for coming from New York. I'll pretend it's for us.
Yes, of course, always.
If you want to come talk with us as a guest host, you can visit the Contact Us page of our website and send in an audio clip. You don't need anything fancy, just headphones with a microphone on them will do fine. Do us a favor though and keep it under 2 minutes so we have time to listen to them all.
And also feel free to suggest a topic via email or on our Facebook or any other social media platform. This is really important so we can talk about things that you want us to.
You can find us on Facebook at R2S Podcast, on Twitter at R2S_podcast, and on Instagram at Return to Sender Podcast. Links to each of these are available on our website, returntosenderpodcast.com.
And of course, you can reach out to us via email at r2spodcast@gmail.com. And remember, all of our twos are the number two and not the word. And please don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a fantastic review.
And if you want to be a patron just like Ben, you can help us out by donating $1 a month on our website to keep the conversation going. And don't forget, we're getting ready to upload some bonus content.
So until next time, I'm Jake.
And I'm Allie.
And you've been listening to Return to Sender.
I'm Caroline.
And I'm Eliza.
And you're listening to Return to Sender.